so that we can't even call individual willfulness absolutely bad. You see, the whole of moral thought does not apply to the evolving person, because he may have to do anything in order to integrate himself. But the thing he mustn't do is follow his inclination, because there's no opposition. Subject to the great law, don't damage your vehicle. Find out what you don't want to do. Find out your inclination and always stop it. We must be very careful that we don't do something stupid and say that we didn't feel inclined to do it, therefore we did it. What we want to find out is existing inclinations, not fabricated ones, and simply stop them. Not do something else. Stop that inclination. And then when we're quite free of inclination, we are then an upright man for the time being, we can then decide in which direction to go next, in order to expose ourselves to a new temptation. So we've got here a very simple diagram of the universe, or of a single cell, or of a human being, when this is his skin surface, and all the processes going on inside his body. And the same rule applies to anything whatever. And the concept of theory in its true origin is the form of the whole, and anything less than the form of the whole is not really theory. Therefore, in the harmonizing of the sciences, what they are looking for today is what they call the great synthesis. The law that is so big that it covers all the apparent exceptions of the individual sciences. Because there are laws in parts of science today that are not true in other parts. Thus the laws of Daltonian chemistry are not true of subatomic particles. There is a big law that covers all laws, and that law is the true meaning of the word theory. And if we take less than that and try to apply it privately, we are automatically deprived of the benefit of the whole theory and must make an error. Error means running away from the whole. And in the error we must suffer a damage, a damn age, an age when we are damned, stopped. And in that damning we must rotate and discursively reason why we have been defeated. And the answer is always the same. We were acting partially, privately, and therefore in a deprived way, instead of using the whole. And if we realize that if we put our consciousness with the whole has already got what we call the perfect act for any part of itself at any moment of history. Supposing it takes for the precession of the equinoxes and the turning of the houses of the zodiac 25,000 years to make one cycle. It means that there is something that can be done in each period. You know that we've just come to a period of strikes, haven't we? The planet Saturn has a periodicity of just about 30 years or less than that. In 1926, 30 years ago, strikes. This is caused by a certain kind of vibration that emanates from the center of precipitation of Saturn and spreads right through the universe, and when it comes into conjunction with certain other forces, it acts on the Earth in such a way that individuation, which is the Saturnine compass, individuation then appears to be very important. So then individuals and groups, which are larger individuals, start demanding what they think are their legitimate rights. And they think they are doing it freely, but they're really doing it as a purely automatic response. In exactly the same way that if you put a seed in the ground 2 days before the full moon, it will come up better than one put 2 days after the full moon. Because the moon draws water to it, and it makes the seed absorb and fatten up and burst and germinate very quickly. And the two processes suggest a mechanical recall. So if we consider this as a world soul, and we consider the formal relations of it, when we consider the necessity of form within it, because it rotates, we are considering the mechanic of it. So the universe, considered as a series of related forms, is mechanical. But so to consider it is abstract thought, because those related forms are not really separate at all. And if we think that they are distinct and not merely different, doing differently, different is difacere, doing different, doing two. If we think they are distinct with the cane that is cut off from each other, we are deceived. So if we think that the universe is merely mechanical, we are deceived, because the mechanical analysis of the universe is an abstract analysis where we deliberately pretend that the universe is not a whole, but is made up of a series of parts. And all the parts in the universe are simply little rotations of the one force in that big spinning sphere. When we consider the whole sphere as form, solidly packed with form, we call it the Sophic sphere, the sphere of wisdom. If we consider it as substantial, plastic substance with form in it, we call it Sophia, the goddess. When we think about it as made of plasticity, clay, which is earth and water put together, we say it is feminine. If we thought about it in terms of air and fire, we say it is masculine. So if we think about the fiery and aerial or initiative and intellectual activities, we call it God, the Father, Son. But if we think about it as plastic substance, water and earth, then we call it God the Mother, or a goddess. Well, of course, the S at the end means this watery flow from it. In the Indian pantheon, you have Vishnu himself, who represents preservative justice, and his consort Lakshmi, who represents mercy. Mercy is simply the fact that the energy flows from one place to another. So just when you can't bear it anymore on a Monday, suddenly it's Tuesday. It means so much energy has flown. This is Lakshmi. See, locality. This lock means place, like the word lock, which implies it. So Lakshmi means overflowing the place. So there's always an end to it. It doesn't matter what they do to you, you can say, in 10 years' time, what will I think about it now? Some people say, it isn't 10 years yet. Already it's today. The toothache is now. Well, never mind. When you're 90, you'd be glad of that tooth, even if it ate. You see, and so on. And this is a climbing out of the merely local. And this leakage of energy out of the local is called Lakshmi, which is the concept of Vishnu, who is the preserving true judge logic of the universe. We can equate, if we like, the preserver with the Logos as this rotating orderly system, the Lord. Actually, if we look at the Hindu Trinity, a series of gods, and we'll see their anagram there from the same one. There are three gods, and they're made out of the same letters. Now this Ishvara is the creator. You put the vowel on the end there so you can say it. Ishvara is creator, Vishnu is preserver, and Shiva is destroyer. Now, we had an emperor called Constantine, who in the 4th century became the first official convert to Christianity in order to pacify his empire, because the Christians were so busy fighting each other about their dogmas that they were cutting the place to bits. So he said, if I become a Christian, then I shall tell them to shut up. So he became a Christian and then told them, come to a conclusion quickly, you are disrupting the empire. And his proof that he should do it was a vision. When he saw a cross, and it went like this. He said that he saw a cross in the sky, like the sky flowers and the moon. And he said, this is Latin. In hoc signo vinces. In this sign shall you triumph. And the Hebrew is Yod Heh Shin Vav or Yehoshua, Jesus.
So the very same form of four letters is the Jesus on the Christian, the Jesus on affirmative horse, or if you want something doing, do it yourself, and the Latin in hoc signo, because in this sign should be triumph. There are other ways of saying this rather rudely by the opponents, but I won't say what those are. Ish va, ish is the same as ish, issue in English, to come out, and v to develop. Ish va, to come out and develop, the creator. The ish, go in again, you see. Ish is preserve, keep this developing, going. So this one and this one are like this. And then Shiva means to let this spirit from outside cross the whole thing off. So in the middle of his forehead you find the god Shiva has an eye, or the eye of Shiva. The pineal gland is related to it in a certain way, that vestigial eye, that atrophied third eye. Shiva means to just cross it off. And it's the same being, namely spirit. This means punctilious, separating spirit development. This means this developing, persisting spirit. This means this separating spirit goes on to that point and just takes it to bits, solves it, washes it away. And it is all the same fellow. And it is all the same fellow with the one we call Jesus, which is Yasus, affirmation, which saves you, to affirm. At one point in your evolution, you should go into the center, affirm the center, in order to learn the law. When you have learned the law, then you should affirm the other way. But you should never move negatively. And two negatives make a positive. So if you never move negatively, you should be moving positively. So you should decide whether you know enough about cosmic law or don't. If you don't, then find out. And the only way you can find out is by obeying it, because you can never find out by disobeying it just precisely what it is. All you can find out by disobeying it is what it is not, and that isn't good enough. Now, we said in this case that from the center spins out a force and is continuously carrying us into temptation. And we have to think of our evolution in terms, in this period, which is called the Kali Yuga, the Black Age, the Age of Iron, of violence, and of industrial revolution, and so on. In this Kali Yuga, what we have to do is try and drive into the center of our beings, because the forces are trying to push us out. And it is only through opposition that we can grow. And it isn't that we want to get into the center prematurely, but it's that if we go the other way, we will not get the opposition we need. So if we go to town and paint it red, and so on, we are not transcending ourselves, we're going the other way. The temptation, the pushing of us to the perimeter of our being, is only to serve as a counterstroke so that we can exert pressure against it. If we don't have this outflow that's carrying us into the five sense world and work against it, we cannot evolve. If we go with it, we can't evolve, we can only go down the drain. Now, if we allowed ourselves to go down the drain and wait a few thousand years, the movement will be going the other way. If we stay down the drain, it'll be hard work, because when it starts going back, it's very, very hard. So we have this twofold motion problem, but for us, in our period, the whole of the motion is symbolized in the fish called the salmon. The salmon is not the twig. The twig is going downstream, which in this diagram is out. The salmon is almost jumping up, but swimming against the stream to get to the source. And that's why we find those three symbols in the Christian Celtic Trinity of the fool, the salmon, and the goose. Where they, remember, the goose is a symbol of reincarnation. It's the white migratory bird. Means the pure soul becoming a fool, and then a salmon striving back. So to be the fool for Christ's sake, we've said, is always to go against that which most people are going for, simply because you get more opposition that way, and you can only grow by opposition. So that we shouldn't want to arrive prematurely, but we should try as hard as we can to get into the centre, which means to obey cosmic law. And cosmic law is very, very simple. It says, the one contains in it the many. And because the many are only modalities of the one, then the many must be treated as if they are the one, because they are the one modalized. So when it says love God, that's the one, and the neighbour is yourself, that's the many. That is the law, and the rest is commentary. And this is the opposition we need, because we have no tendency to do it. We have no tendency to love all, so we can get the opposition out of trying to. It doesn't matter whether we succeed or not. What matters is that we try, because we're looking for the opposition which alone can integrate us. So that as far as we're concerned, in this Black Age, this Kali Yuga, this Iron Age of violence and invention, the whole of our problem is how to behave as if people were not separate. When all their behaviour, which is primitive behaviour on this diagram, all their behaviour says that they are separate. We needn't be scared stiff of people suddenly reforming them and depriving us of the exercise of loving our enemies. They won't be doing it for some time yet. Now, have we got any particular points in here that are not quite clear?
Well, there's one thing that arose after something you said there quite surprised me, really. You spoke about small wills will obscure ideas for you. And you said it was concerned with not wanting to be controlled. Now, could an external situation that has happened to you make a difficulty for you if you're trying to get control internally?
Oh, yes. What you are calling an external situation shows that you have forgotten this diagram. Good night. There's our universe again. There is nothing external to it. There is no thing external to it. External to it is not a thing, it is absolute spirit. So that all problems are internal. All these forces are whizzing round inside here, and one of them is you, but it's only a little turn. It's like that. Something is going in and something is going out. You call it food and stimulus going in, excrement and action going out. And that is just an enlargement of that. Now you're talking about an external situation acting upon you and making difficulties for you on the inside. You can only be talking about some of the other motion that this belongs to, can't you? Coming into you and making it difficult for you to decide just whether you're doing this or not.
I can say that the situation I found myself in was one that at the time gave me a very rough time, and I think it made me slightly anti towards authority, and so much so that I think that I have attempted to either evade or oppose the grip of authority. Because what happened to me was that I found myself in a position at the age of 14 where, as far as authority was concerned, no matter what I did, I was wrong. And it was very, very difficult for me at the time. I can explain it further by saying that a situation happened which a lot of people wanted to know about. I was the most available to be asked, and if I was asked, I'd done wrong by telling them. If I didn't tell them, I'm as bad as far as they were concerned because I wasn't stepping on. But the result that I was as though I was in a trap. And if I didn't tell them, I always found myself in extreme difficulties because I had told them. So I started to evade direct questions like that by not giving the full facts. I don't think I've ever given the full facts on things since. I always deflect, with the result that I have found since that people will come to you with an idea of you in their mind, and from that idea they will attempt to find out more about you. But if you allow them to think that their idea is the right one, they've then got the wrong one, and you've deflected them from it. And I think that that has perhaps been the sort of thing that when I start to think about this work, I get so far, and then all sorts of vagaries come out. I can't grasp the
thing. You see, supposing this is a diagram of you, and this now represents a little idea in you. And that little idea was a secret. But in this diagram, there is another being out here knocking on you and saying, tell me that secret. But there's another being outside here saying, don't you tell that secret. If you do tell it, you please this one and annoy that one. If you don't tell it, you please that one and displease that one. You're in the middle in all such problems. Now, the point was, it was a temptation. It was a temporal presentation, but you didn't understand that at the time. What you did was try to compromise between those two in the same way that the heart tries to compromise between the head and the belly. And it's a legitimate analysis at that stage. But now you can transcend that by looking at it in another way. Each one of those has exactly the same problem that you've got. Namely, forces turning round which have to be put in order. If you let that one know, this one has a problem of equilibration. If you refuse to let that one know, that one's problem is found here. So the question is, what should you do? What is your governing concept for dealing with two people, one of whom wants to know something to balance himself, which will depend on unbalancing another being, and the other one wants you not to let that be known, so that that can be balanced at the expense of that? What should you do about it? Can you see your governing concept that you need?
That's what's wanted, isn't it? If we alter this diagram by taking a snippet out here, make a pyramid, and say down there there's a lot of people we call impulses, up there there's a few administrators, and on the top there's a king. And that king can only keep his position if somebody in the middle keeps these people down below in order. But if he's a good king, he doesn't want to be bothered by these people. Because it's not worth being a king if you've got to keep your ministers ministered to, is it? So what you want to do is set up a shield here, like the cabinet, and then another shield like the Privy Council, and then Parliament, and so on. These shields are doing the work of frightening all the forces below, so that that part at the top can do nothing. They sit there and eat his lolly. Now that's the ideal, isn't it? Because the centre of your being should be still. Because if there isn't something still in you, you're going to be in a mess and you can't judge properly. And your perimeter won't be still because it's constantly being stimulated from outside. So you want the centre to be still. So you have to consider the relation there. Internally, we can say it's the relation between this part of yourself to this and this.
When a being is in a certain position, he needs temptation of a certain order. He needs to be presented with a problem of the kind that you are presented with, to see what he will do with it. And according to what he does with it, so will be the thing that happens to him next. So if without hesitation, a gentleman asks, where is so-and-so? He committed the robbery last night, and you say, he's in the Blue Unicorn down the corner now. Without hesitation, well, you're sort of demoted, because you haven't even had the beginnings of an epistrophic process. You didn't reflect. So you'll be pushed down a bit lower. The next test you get will be on a lower level. So if you want a higher test, you look at the situation and you don't give that information to the authorities, even though you know very well that the whole stability of the king, God bless his soul, rests on it. Because you say, sorrow must come, and woe to him by whom, and I'm moving out. Get your information from another bloke who needs a lesson. Now when you become very, very clear about that, you will not tell any authority, you will never be stool-pigeoned about anything, because there is always another one who needs a lesson more than you do, and out of the generosity of your heart, why should you deprive it? And if you think about it that way, the test shuffles down the scale, down this pyramid, right to the bottom level. This is what Christ meant when he said, when he's coming into Jerusalem, and they're all shouting and saying, oh, the Messiah's here. And somebody complains and says, what are all these people shouting this nonsense? He said, if they didn't shout, the stones would cry out. If you don't blow the gas, somebody at a low level will. And if all people were strong enough not to tell, then the plants would have to start pointing. And he went that way. If they resisted it, stones would have to roll and say, follow me. That's the meaning of the elevation of the universe, the dominion that Adam was supposed to exercise. To put all the dirty jobs down at the bottom. Actually, we find a lot of people fairly near the top that will do dirty jobs. And then they got demoted for it. We find little fellows like Bevan doing a dirty job now in order to climb up. Bevin did another one. Ramsay MacDonald did one, and it's got a stinking reputation ever since. You see, when they do a dirty job that's way below their own level, they only prove that they never should have been up, really. That somehow they were flung up suddenly. They didn't get up by integration. They got up by social climbing in contact, and it isn't good enough. So you've got a very, very simple test case there. Everything you analyse is in terms of you. Any people outside yourself are just aspects of your own being, because in this big diagram we said that the form is always becoming all forms, all the time, and therefore every person is every other person as well as himself. And therefore if you meet a certain man, you've already got that man inside yourself, otherwise you couldn't respond. You couldn't even respond to temptation if you hadn't got the impulse to do so. So you shift the problem from outside to inside. So if a fellow comes to you and said, where is so-and-so? You look for him inside yourself and say, yes, where is he? And the fellow outside thinks you're a bit dull. I must tell you an amusing incident that happened last week. We went to see the Ten Commandments on Friday night. And while we were there, paying myself, John Jarrett and Donald, we went in John's car and we put the car on the park. While we were in the cinema seeing the Ten Commandments, some local robbers borrowed John's car, went up to Cheatham, did a robbery with it, disposed of the stuff and put it back on the car park all within 3/4 of an hour. So when some eyewitnesses saw the car and gave the number to the police and described the men, three men and a girl, men with beards or stubbly chins, the police followed John going home and caught him up, cross-questioned him, and he is supported by the police, and it's quite possible in his excitement said that he had been to see War and Peace. We'd been discussing very long films before he went home. They then came round to me to check his story, And when they told me, I burst out laughing and said to the detective, do you think a fellow who's 6 feet 5 inches tall, that's what John is, with a full beard and a car of that vintage with a high back and as long as a bus would go in for robberies? And the detective got very, very annoyed because I wasn't taking his dignity properly, you see. And he said, at the moment it's only a larceny case, but it could go to a higher court if we don't settle it. All I did with him was joke about it all the time and described just how stupid it would be for a fellow like me and a fellow like John Jenner to indulge in that sort of thing in that kind of car, you know. Really, I wasn't answering any of his questions that he wanted. I was talking in a very light manner about it and poo-pooing it and saying, I said, we could have been guilty. I mean, all sorts of funny things cross the mind at times. It happened on this occasion that it was not so. And when I said we've been to see the Ten Commandments, he thought I was telling lies. And they're still not satisfied, so John is still under suspicion. Now, the point is that if you can keep your sense of humour, and humour is HMR, fundamentally, which is the same thing as your spirit, is occupying your substance and lifting it, differentiating it, so you can see all the possibilities. If you only see one or two possibilities and those bad ones, you are said to be depressed. But if you see a lot of possibilities, you feel much lighter about it. And you do not have to respond to a stimulus at a level that the presenter of the stimulus wants you to. You can respond at another level by simply saying, well, I've got a policeman inside me. I know what it's like. The fellow who would join the police force and spend his time bucking up defenceless robbers, who are quite obviously not habilitated properly, is a bad impulse, you see. What would I do with it internally? The answer is I wouldn't give it an inch. And yet they exist on the outside, all right? Let them exist on the outside. Sorrow must come, and no doubt robberies must be done. But they don't have to be done by me, nor stopped by me. It's a problem for some other beings. And when we can see that these external problems have to be solved inside by us first, then we're understanding what the world is about. Because every part of that Sophic sphere is stimulating every other part so that all parts can understand the whole possibilities of the whole. And that gives tolerance. Tolerance is what the engineers call dither. It's a bit of space in between where you put the oil that enables the machinery to run.
One of the remarkable things that came to me out of this idea of allowing people to have their own idea of you instead of telling them what you were like or anything like that, was that you could tell where it would go and who would bring it back. You could follow people through with it. You could tell who had told who what, because it was their idea and not your idea. Trace of it somehow.
You have to be very careful about that, because you can get a sort of lower fourth form devil's attitude towards it, of sniggering about your capacity for seeing which way it went. You can start working at a petty devil's level of deliberately not saying things in order to see what happens. In fact, you can even go worse. You can start saying things that are not true to particular people that you know are weak, knowing that they will recite them to another person and then there'll be trouble. You've got to continuously restate that you are supposed to be integrating you, and that everything that happens to you from outside happens because you are at a certain level. If you respond to the external situation in the right way, your next test will be higher, more worthwhile. If you respond badly, you'll be demoted. You'll get a lower and lower test. And this is a question of selecting the right kind of test, because a lot of tests are presented to you simultaneously. If you go down the road, there's an opportunity for a smash and grab there. There's a lady there trying to cross the road, and she's got rheumatism in both ears, and you've got to get her across the road. Meanwhile, there's a little thing tripping along that might be more appreciative of aid. You're presented with a lot of things at once. And when you understand that everything you do to the external world is done to the internal equivalent, You can only integrate yourself in a certain way, and you will then deliberately select the thing that will elevate you most surely.
What will cause you to tell you?
Well, your vision, your intelligent appraisal of the real situation. You can't see that unless you're in a real situation. You make a hypothetical situation, you will make a hypothetical reply. Yeah.
Maybe it's
just
maybe.
Yes.
Good night.
Good night.
Can I have a go?
Pardon?
Can I have a go?
Yes, do.
2 weeks ago, you gave us the Greek phi to represent division.
Yeah.
And we also got the Greek theta, which is actually the same thing the other way up.
Yeah.
It's actually one side.
Yeah.
Can you put the two together and call them the crossing that is blank, intelligent will and passive?
You can do that very easily. The origin of the whole alphabet is there. Now, if we take this one out, it is the first letter of philosophy. It means analysis. But analysis is death to your will, because when you divide an idea into its constituents, you cut the whole will. But if you take out this one and put it that way, that's the Greek theta, which is the first letter of the Greek word for death, thanatos. And they used to mark men that were ready for capital punishment with that sign.
Yeah.
And that is the sign of passivity, isn't it? The horizontal. And that is the sign of activity, the vertical. So when you're actively engaged dividing, that's the philosophy. But when you're passively dividing, you're a dead man. And both derive from this, active, passive.
Yes, now what I really missed out there was the fact that theory and philosophy is, you know, I'm going to go the phi being the first letter of philosophy.
Yeah.
And the theta being the first letter of theory.
Yes.
Now I want to know how they are opposed to one another, the theory and philosophy.
Well, you know, some people say that theory is dead.
Yes.
Don't they? Now, that is an initiation statement from long ago, which survives in an ordinary expression, in ordinary everyday speech. Because the theory of the thing is the whole, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the theory, being whole, is absolutely unalterable. There can be nothing new in it. And the absolutely unalterable is said to be dead.
Yeah.
You see that? In German we get sterben zu leben. Die in order to live. Get your theory right so that your life process can be right. But your theory is dead, I hope. Because if you had a theory that wasn't dead, it would keep changing. You'd have to keep relearning it. What we want is something that is absolute for all worlds. Like Richard II in jail, hammering out on his brain with his soul for a hammer, the structure of the universe.
Would you say stable and actual stable?
Stability, yes. So the idea of death is really the idea of equilibrium, of stability. The idea in physics of entropy. Entropy is the dead state when all the forces of the universe are equilibrated. The Sanskrit term for it is pralaya, which means the reason laying down. And when the whole process is done, they call it the mahapralaya, which is the great reason lying down. It's the same concept. Dead is finished, completed, no change. This is why Paul says there is no death. O death, where is thy sting? Because although there is a whole reason, the purna, or the theory of the universe, which cannot change, yet, the application of that in the time process means unending change. World without end. Actually, that word theta itself means God crucified. Just like this other one,
is the root of love, philos. Because you have then the circle and the force penetrating it in order to produce a system.
With the two together?
Well, the two together is the same as life and death.
Yeah.
Active, passive. The circumscribed and the non-circumscribed. The quartan, the four parts of your being.
Changed and changeless.
Yeah. See, in the paralogic, you take all these things to bits and you put them all back again. And remember that they all imply each other. Doesn't matter what word you start with, really. If you define a word, you'll have to use other words.
Yes.
In fact, you'll have to use the whole of your vocabulary adequately to define one word. Lewis Carroll was well aware of this as a logician and theologian. He said, making Humpty Dumpty say it, sitting on the wall, between being and non-being, there's the wall. Humpty Dumpty sat on the wall. Now the king's horses and the king's men are inside that circle. Humpty Dumpty is sitting on the wall, and Alice is the soul. And Humpty Dumpty says, I make words do what I want them to do. But some of them are rather awkward.
Alice is all eyes. All eyes, Alice, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. Which is the same thing as the panops. The old panops, which is the universal I, which is many one, one many, simultaneously. It is the cosmic soul which contains all other souls in it as attributes. Humpty Dumpty makes words mean what he wants them to mean. That's the same as private purpose. But he says some of them are very, very awkward. And the awkward ones, I have to pay them extra. Now, paying them extra means that if you falsely define a word, you will have to define some other words falsely to bolster up the first one. That's called paying extra. While he's busy explaining how clever he is and the promise that's been made, he falls off the wall and breaks in bits. In other words, he gets inside this rotor, which is a centrifuge, and he's flung to bits. And the king's horses and the king's men cannot put him together again because he's inside there. He's Humpty, which is the spirit, substantialized, posited and crucified, and Dumpty, flung in. Remember that in all those nursery rhymes, fairy stories, myths and so on, you've got the same cosmic thing all the time presented to you. In the children's hour the other day they had a puppet play of the Sleeping Beauty. Again, the Sleeping Beauty is the soul. And a wicked witch, which is the same thing as the unreformed Magdalene, if you like, the belly urge, gets that soul and said, I will kill you. But that is its antithesis. There is a good fan that said, you won't, you'll only put her to sleep for 100 years. And 100 is 10 times 10. And 10 means ordinal perfection. And 100 means ordinal perfection, a lot of it. In the Bible, when it says 1,000, it means a bit too much of it. 1,000 means multiplication of details. Petty niggling in bureaucratic form, for me. We would say it's 1,000. Is enough, not too little, of ordinal perfection. And at the end of that time, when the soul has got ordinal perfection in its sleep, which means a sleep of daily experience, which people think is being awake, then there comes the prince, who is the first, the prince is the first state, who is, as male, the logos, the original logos, which then enters into the time process in the soul, because the soul has now got ordinal perfection. Whereupon then the soul wakes up and the whole process is carried on and the wicked witch's curse is dissolved. Now every fairy story says the same story, just disguised in any country.
I like things to be comfortable, you see. Mm-hmm. I like to think that... At least I used to like to think that God was a supernatural being, that's what I thought it was, wasn't it? And I used to like to think that the idea of life was harmonious. Now, I wanted to ask you, although you've partly answered, as you progress towards integration, should your health and your ordinary external circumstances improve, or should they represent a series of tests to you?
Well, you know, health is wholeness, and man hasn't got it. And until the whole of humanity is integrated, then no single one of them can be fully integrated. Because as we said before on that diagram, every person is all, and the disturbances emanating from some affect all. So if there are, it's like in the body, if you get a tiny bit of indigestion makes you feel depressed, doesn't it? A local inflammation, like a boil or something, can make you feel depressed. It's not much, but it affects the whole body. In the same way, one sick man in the universe makes the whole universe not quite right. Now, God is the universal soul. He is a person. He does care for everything that's inside it. But everything inside it is still free to do what it wants within the framework of being. And he's determined to make them harmonious. But he's determined not to use a violent method of getting harmony, but to leave it to the automatic free will of beings within himself to react on each other, and so, by consciously facing their problems, to become more and more aware of the necessity for universal harmony before an individual can complete his process. Thus it is said of Buddha, that he said, "I will not go into nirvana until everybody else is in." He meant to say that he was thoroughly aware that the universe being one fundamental continuous substance, peace is impossible for anyone till all had got it. God's compassion, the fact that God incarnates and becomes crucified, is only evidence that God felt something going on that necessitated compassion. You cannot expect to go through your life steadily improving in health, wealth, late rising and lots of money and so on. All the so-called mammon objects do not automatically accrete to you if you start being good. A terrible thing could happen to you if you thought that was so, because you could then start attracting those material goods, including physical health. And you could find yourself with a very, very bad problem. Namely, the problem that you would have to face if you became so healthy that everybody you had ever known had died and left you in a world where nobody knew you, and you were healthy and old and outdated, anachronistic, talking nonsense, and you prayed for death. Every test has to be taken at its own level. And you mustn't expect to be ill, and you mustn't expect to be well. Those are irrelevant. Because being ill is only a disequilibrium through which you go. And being well is a temporary state for us in the time process.
And a question?
Yes?
In a lot of cases we make our soul ill, don't we?
Do you mean freely?
By a wrong attitude to life we may attract bad influences, so-called bad influences to the body.
Oh, yes.
And that as we grow wise, we actually stop doing the thing that attracts that ill health or that lack of money, which isn't really necessary. We'll perhaps get enough to...
Be very, very careful about that.
For a start, we would start behaving in a manner that wouldn't attract too much ill health anyhow.
By definition of too much. But how much would be too much, you can't say.
The point is this, that once you know what you're doing, there's certain alterations going to be made.
Once you know what you're doing, 100% and all the time, you're beyond the level of accident, aren't you?
Yes.
And when you get there, let me know. Because until then, you will know only so much. And the part you don't know will always be putting you in a situation which you'll have to face.
Well, let's look at it this way. A psychiatrist says, okay, forgive so and so and get rid of your rheumatics, you see. So you do, and you get rid of the rheumatics, and this is a known case.
Hmm.
Now, in that particular way, you've actually accreted a little better health, haven't you?
You may not have done. You might have got rid of one symptom and showed another one. Supposing you say to somebody, forgive that person in order to get rid of your rheumatism.
Mm.
That's a terribly selfish motive.
I find things as they are a little bit unbearable, actually. I don't like things.
That's a negative, it won't do. You see, the only reason we should integrate is because when we have integrated, it'll take the weight off everybody else, as well as us. Because the whole process is one. If we're not careful, we can make a terrible error of trying to become perfect in order to avoid difficulty. And that isn't what we want to be perfect for. What we want to be perfect for is so the difficulties don't bother us, whatever they are. We should be able to go in an eternal evolving world with new souls continuously coming in and suffering. And we should be so integrated that we don't care if we go down into hell to help some of them that are going a bit backsliding to start coming out, because we've transcended the idea of passive active or suffering or joying and so on. If we get the wrong motive, we'll get the wrong result. You see, about the will, we have a very, very simple test. Either we like it or we don't. About ideas, they're very complex. About the will, either I like it or I don't. If you move because you don't like something, it is negative. You've got to have your will directed towards a worthwhile positive.
Well, the point is this, you see, I mean, one can be so frightened of annihilation, you see, that death may bring, that he couldn't possibly do any good at all until he got rid of that notion.
Well, if a man believes that he is annihilated at death, he's suffering from an erroneous idea, isn't he?
I suppose you're not sure, you see. I mean, everybody's been telling me that there's a North Pole, but I've never been there. I've got to accept it, you see, on faith, you see, that they didn't cheat me.
Well, tell me, why do you believe there's a North Pole when you've only been told and you've not been?
As I said, because there's certain people who I've been taught to trust as being authority certain subjects, and therefore I've got to take the word for it because of the overwhelming number of these authorities.
You know, the other night on TV there was a program about evolution. Did you see it?
No.
And beforehand they said, we are going to present a program that proves that Darwin was right. The actual differences between Darwin's evolutionary theory and the theories of others were not discussed. But an embryo was showed with grooves in it, and it said, these are not the gill slits of a fish, but they're in the same place and they are like them, therefore men came from fish. That isn't good logic. And he'd already shown a lizard with five thingamabobbies, four toes like fingers, and various other things with five, a seal. Why didn't he say men came from lizards or seals? If a point of similarity is a proof of origin, why doesn't he say that they came from us? Because we've got them. It hasn't been proved scientifically that man is a later thing. He might have been hiding all the time. You see, there was a bias. It's the modern bias that we call the will to improve, which postulates that a long time ago people were tremendously ignorant and had very little brains. When they examined the skull of the Aurignacian man and found that it was bigger than that of a modern average man and very well shaped, they were startled. They still haven't quite accepting it, that the fellow was not stupid, he was a very clever fellow, and he was contemporary with another fellow who was stupid and who was eliminated, like the Neanderthal man. They want to believe that once upon a time things were stupid and they gradually improved until we arrived. This is called the myth of continuous progress. It ignores the fact that the universe is round, that everything is cyclic, and then when it reaches its term, it disappears. If people are as intelligent as most of the Huxley brand would like to pretend, then to talk about fear of accidentally releasing atom bombs is rubbish. Some Americans take a plane over the North Pole and nearly frighten the Russians, and some Russians fly about and nearly frighten the Americans. And then they said the other day, if it happens that some of their men and some of our men happen to be flying towards each other, They might think it's an attack. They start dropping things. And the real danger of the moment is fear that somebody might drop a bomb, because somebody may drop a bomb if they're afraid. Is that a sign we've improved? It isn't a sign at all. There's no integration of any magnitude in human beings on the whole. The few who've got it don't get themselves involved in that sort of scrape.
Did they integrate for the purpose of integrating? It happens as a byproduct of trying to help humanity, which came first.
Now that's very, very important, because you cannot integrate unless you intend to help.
Can you?
You can call it a byproduct of the intent to help, because if you haven't got the intent to help, you will never integrate. Remember, it's the will that does it, and if you don't intend to help others towards it, you haven't got a unified will. Because we've said that one man is all men. On our diagram here, we've shown by that rotation that every man is receiving from all men, and therefore he doesn't even know what's his own. The idea that is in his mind isn't his idea, everybody's got it. The stress varies in individuals, but not the content. And therefore, only if you want to make the whole universe whole can you integrate. Because if you tried to integrate with any other purpose of making the whole, you'd be illogical.
Now, by overcoming these various aspects of the lower nature, will we actually see this to be the method of acting, actually? If we overcome all the lower urges and bring them under control, will we actually see that we've got to do this?
Oh, yes, yes. Now, you know that exercise we did once, when I gave you something and asked you to do something, and you threw it down? Now, that kind of feeling that arose in you then was tremendously important. Because there is always something that if you were very, very refined in your feeling, you would do. Because it would be the very thing to do at that moment. It may not be a thing that everybody else would like, because it may introduce a temporary disequilibrium, a temporary ill health in them. But it would be in the right direction. And after a time, you would be forgiven for having done it. Although it upset people at the moment. That feeling is only awareness of your will intent when it is identified with the universal will. But you've introduced it yourself, it's come out of you, and therefore you're ready to consider this fact, that if you don't will the wholeness of the whole, you cannot integrate. No amount of effort, no amount of cleverness of fitting ideas together will fit them if you are merely trying to integrate yourself as a finite individual. Oh, good. Is it nice?
I have something along the fact that if we have, let's say, stimulating drugs and that, we feel like doing lots of good and nothing wrong. And I had experience that personally. And I was thinking of something along the lines of we get a certain amount of integration and we feel we've got loads of energy to spare and we want to do good. You see? Now, is it something else
about
starving?
Nothing to do with it.
Nothing to do with it at all.
If you've got a feeling you want to do good, it's automatically wrong in that sense. That kind of feeling, isn't it? There's no urgency about it. It's quite different from the kind of feeling that most people get when they say, I want to do so-and-so. I would like to help you, and so on. Those things are inclinations. And when you're learning integration, you're not concerned with inclinations of that order. When you get to another order, a new kind of emotion appears, a new kind of feeling. It's not gushy, it's not zeal, but it does more and more persistently and more often, and always with conscious control of the situation.
Is what I put to you a private purpose? If I explain what it
was. Yes, yes.
Selfish.
Yes. By definition it is. It didn't include the whole of the whole, did it? It was a false stress, you see. And those false stresses are the things that attract the thing that you think you want and then invert it into its opposite. You've got to be terribly careful about what you say is valuable, because you might get it.
Is that parasite again?
Mm-hmm. You know that the moment you introduce an idea as valuable into yourself, you have already introduced fear that you may not get it. And that fear is a disintegrating force. If you had absolute faith in this wholeness of the universe and yourself as a sort of spinning force within it, and that force is intelligent, you would know that your evolution is already perfect. All you have to do is realize your perfection of being. In the time process, you're continuously presented with a statement that you're imperfect by imperfect beings. Beings in a state of suffering or pain who assure you that the universe is no good, and they tend to taint your imagination and make you falsely value things. When it says in the book, he who has faith does not hurry up, that's what it means. The universe is already whole. We are inside it. Nothing can get out of it and nothing can get into it without its will. Everything that happens inside it is happening by the spontaneous development of universal will, and your private will within it is only private because you privated it. So deficiency is really willed. The other day a fellow was talking to me, and he was talking about kindness and how he never gets any from his dear wife. And he was in such a state of misery, I said to him, well, you know, she doesn't have a life of continuous joy, does she? And he bounced and he said, do you really think not? And I said, of course not. But you know, well, I feel better now. You see? And that was that terrible justice idea. Surely there's a God in the world. Surely you twist her arm for her. This kind of little individual bias is pursuing something. He thinks he wants heaven. He thinks that there can be a new heaven and a new earth, and that they might get the new heaven on this new earth now, if only wifey will behave and stop throwing the chips on the wallpaper.
Is it universal, all this idea to think it's nice to have things nice?
It's not nice to have things nice if we don't deserve it. We should deserve it, shouldn't we? We should be fit for it. We should be in such a state when we get it that we won't throw it away.
Isn't our tendency, though, always to consider that we are fit for it as individuals? It's other people that they're lacking.
Never found that. Not in a man that examines himself. I've heard people say it, but never believe it. I've never seen a man that sits back and says, really, well, I'm ready for perfection. It's just those other can't. Not really. He may say so, but that's just diversion.
You see all sorts of people today, though, that are striving to improve their homes.
Mow the lawn, flatter and flatter.
But it's a direction of the will towards an improvement, isn't it?
An improvement of what? The lawn?
To your circumstances?
We said that if you don't go against your inclination, you cannot integrate yourself. Those people that make the lawn flat, if you said to them, do you know your lawn is sticking up in the middle? They get excited. Unless it isn't, you know. Well, it must be because it's part of the earth, you know, and that's round. So if you make it really flat, it'll be relatively concave and the rain will collect in the centre. Won't it? They won't like that idea. They want it flat. I tell that to a fellow who was very fond of playing billiards once. And if his billiard table were really flat, all the balls would roll to the centre. And he ran around the room and shouted and said it was stupid. So I did him a big drawing of the world with a big billiard table going straight and showed him that it was farther away from the earth on the ends than it was in the middle. And therefore, relatively, it was an inclined plane and balls put on it must roll towards the centre. And he was very upset. And he said, you're not going to put me off my game. Because he thought he'd have to make allowances for it. This is the real meaning of private purpose, isn't it? To see things in a very peculiar way, just as you want them, and not to want to know anything else. One of the early Greeks, thinking about the sun, made the statement, the sun is bigger than Greece. Whereupon they said, if you say that again, we'll kill you. You see? They liked it that way. Remember what happened when they altered the calendar? After it got 11 days out in England, and they had to make up for the 11 days, the mob came with stones and they shattered every window in every official building in London, shouting, we want our 11 days back. Just because they'd altered the calendar. They thought they'd somehow managed to nip out 11 days. It was a genuine belief, because they thought they were being robbed. And they knew that governments rob you of everything possible, and therefore they knew that they'd take 11 days away. You have to be very careful what you define as your good. Because remember, your gullet is more fond of carpet slippers in general than it is of hard work. But it can't evolve and get what it wants without refuting itself as prime inclination. Schopenhauer we're talking about today. Schopenhauer is a German pessimist. He was a pessimist because he learned from Indian sources, from the Upanishads, that the world is will manifesting as idea, and the will wants to do something which it can't do because it doesn't know how. So then it decides to learn how. And when it learns how, what it learns is that it can't do it, because when you learn how, you become reasonable. And the reason refutes the irrational will. So he sat down and cried bitterly about that and got a very funny face, which is a marvellous thing to look at. If you get a good portrait of Schopenhauer, you will see what it means to believe that the will, when it becomes reasonable, is dissatisfied. And it's significant that he became a woman hater in the process. Be careful how you define what you're after, because you may get it. And whatever you get, something goes with it.
I've got to do good as well, you see. I'm not going to do the good because I want to integrate. No, just do it because it's good. Yeah. It's going to make me feel better. It's going to make me better all the way around. But I'm not going to do it for that reason.
No, that's right. If you do it for that reason, you'll go wrong. The Bhagavad Gita is about nothing else except action without regard to the fruits.
The point is this: you feel horrible, so you do it, so you won't feel horrible anymore. You're not got to be that way.
No. Do it because it's better. Do the right because the right is better than the wrong. Have a good will because a good will is better than the bad one. Quite independently of the fruits to you in the process. The fruits come, but don't look at them, you'll get into trouble.
May I say this? I stopped smoking, you see, 4 months ago. The simple purpose, I want to integrate. Now, I've stopped smoking once before, about a year. Now, the first time it was a test of willpower, you see. Now, after I actually got rid of the habit, I turned around and said, it's better not to smoke. And I thought, what will happen in this particular case? We overcome things egotistically, first of all. And then after overcoming them, or to a certain extent overcoming them, we turn around and say, it's better not to behave the other way.
That's right.
Is that what it is?
Yes. Actually, come in the end to will good because it's good.
We mustn't pay any attention to the fruit.
If you do, you'll fall.
Afterwards, I mean, after the event, after you've done the thing, you're not allowed to enjoy the good feeling it might bring.
Suppose you spontaneously do a very good deed for a little old lady crossing the road, and she has a basket and you carry it across, and she says, because you've carried it, you can have that lovely Jaffa orange which is in it. You see, and she presses it on you and you go home. So you eat it. But if it conditions your behaviour in any way whatever so that you look for little old ladies with baskets, you're in trouble. And as soon as you start looking for fruits,
You've gone off your will, which is the only thing that you are concerned with. The orange tastes exactly the same, you see, whether you bought it, or had it given to you, or earned it, or stole it.
Yes, but if you don't do it because you think you might get an orange, when you've done it, you feel a bit better about things. You're quite pleased because you did do it. You're not entitled to enjoy that feeling.
Enjoy? What do you mean? You're entitled to recognise that it's there.
That's what I want to know.
That feeling only shows that a bit of energy that was locked up has been released and has been made available for you. You know, there are some people who get terribly trapped because they become good deed doers because of that feeling.
They drink a bit.
And they become horrible prigs later.
I don't mean to do the things only because of a good feeling.
You shouldn't do it because of a good feeling at all. Leave that till you get to heaven. Just do it. Do it, and when the good feeling comes, just recognise that was a good feeling. But of course it should be, it was a good act. But that's not why I did it. Look at the inherent logic of it.
I shouldn't be miserable about having a good feeling. But
it's very hard to be miserable about a good feeling. Try it. It's an exercise, isn't it? Try and make yourself miserable when you just won that thingy-boy. It's a real tendency when you do a good deed to feel better, and then the next thing you just think, oh, I'll do it because I felt better. But when you do that, you've altered the relation, the field relation between yourself and the person you do the good deed to. And if you're not careful, that person will say, I know why you're doing this, you felt good last time, didn't you?
See?
Yes. There it is, you see, it's that hairline stretching between here and there, and you've got to keep on it. It's the narrow way. It's not Aristotelian's golden mean, you see. The Aristotelian view of the mean is very mean. It's petty, steering between difficulties with great care. What Christ was talking about was something entirely different. Keep your will on it, sufficient for the day's evil thereof. Do what you can. If something nice comes, don't divert yourself and say, where did that come from? Is there any more good deeds I can do over there? A good scout on Bob a Job Week does his job, he looks at the Bob, and he doesn't think specifically that he should have done the job for the Bob. If he's a proper scout, he can give the Bob away, won't he? To the cause.
The scout suit has the idea, and I've just wondered where they got that scout uniform.
No, but as Gurdjieff said in the beginning, it must be an egotistical act. It must be.
Not it must be, unless you understand what the word must means.
Well, let's say it usually.
What does the word
in this case, anyhow?
What does the word must mean?
Well, it implies no other way.
Does it?
Must.
Does it imply there's no other way? It's actually, it means your primary appetite is self-crucified. If you must do it, you're talking about the direction of your own will. Actually, it's a technical term for what elephants feel when they're sexually excited. They're said to be on must. You see? The most. Goethe says, when you know Goethe when he was very old, he hadn't quite, he was a bit like Moses, he was still in the fullness of his powers. When he was 74, he fell in love with a girl of 17 and then cried because nobody would let him marry her. And said, what has age got to do with it? I've got a young heart. And then he said, ich lieben, weil ich lieben muss. I love because I must. But you know, he was a very, very good philologist, and he knew that the German müssen meant primary will squirting itself out. Now, must you? That depends whether you've got the power to turn it back. And that's must not. With a K in it.
A lot of people think that they must do things, and you suddenly give them a bit more information, and then they must not. Must only means that will driving and crucifying itself.
Right now I'm using a name. I'm using the name Haraway. You seem to speed things up. So I call the house Haraway.
Wow.
The point is this. When I start to think about it too much, I want to take it down again because I start to think, well, I don't know. It might mean I'm going to die tomorrow because in a 1,000 years' time it will speed me up somewhat, you see. I don't know that.
You don't know?
No. It makes me think about whether I should use it.
Well, you see, that's the thing.
Yeah.
A friend of mine, thinking about names, changed his own name recently, and then his wife changed her name to Hera, who is the wife of Zeus, and she's become absolutely the authority about the place. And then she said to me, my husband is thinking of changing his name to Zeus. So I said, well, do you know what Zeus did? She said, no, what did he do? Well, that shows the level. She takes on a name without examining the meaning of any of it. I said, well, Zeus spent all his time dodging his wife Hera and nipping to earth and seducing all the adorable maidens there. Oh, she said, that's the game, is it? She said, he's not going to be called Zeus. I said, that's exactly what Hera did in the whole of the mythology, spent her time interfering with him. Zeus means the glistening ether. Hera is the power ripple that goes through it. She's the power ripple that goes through his glistening ether. He's sitting there glistening as he keeps going through. Ken knows him. But he does glisten, doesn't he? You feel it, eh? You see, it's an invocation, isn't it? The Hera way, that means so that you have chosen the way of the hierarchical powers. That means you believe there's something below you and something above you, and that you'd rather be up than down. And that you're asking that power to come and lift you up.
We did it very quickly. I just got thrown out of the place over there.
Oh, yeah. It's an amazing thing. You know, the biggest power centre of atomic research, well, the first project, it was Haribel, wasn't it?
Yeah.
For the same reason. It's a Hera function. And in the mythology of the Indians, the naughty god Hari, the same fellow, is the fellow who goes about looking for ambitious people and persuading them to become followers of Hari. And he's always got a dirty job for them to do when they've got up. He makes them up and up and up and up, and they think, yes, it's quite right, I'm doing God good service by elevating myself. Suddenly they say, now you're a governor, you see. And we want these 50,000 blokes there burning and making into soap. It doesn't matter. They'll only write a rude word about you in the history books and you won't be here all the time. You see? When Hitler, whose name was Schicklgruber, you see, changed his name from Schicklgruber to Hitler, he chose a name meaning to break truces and use violence. That's the definition of the Hittites. The Hittite law was what he chose. His real name was Schicklgruber, sent from the grave. He's a dead man, come from below. And his Austria is outside the law of Germany, and the Germans hate the Austrians, therefore they're biased to listen to one if he's got the nerve to speak. And you try it, keep it a bit. You're not the first person I know that chose it and tried it a bit.
Oh, and I intend to.
Keep it as long as you can.
Well, I tell you what happened. I was threatened to be thrown out. The last moment of going out, they rather turned back and wished they hadn't done. I landed in a very good place.
For the moment.
Now, everything's gone suspiciously quiet this last few weeks.
This can be a good thing for you, because the universe has got a hierarchy in it, and providing you keep your will right, and you will only the wholeness of the whole, and not simply you, it won't do you any harm, and it will accelerate you.
I'm still suspicious of quietness.
Well, as long as you're suspicious of the quietness, you'll be all right.
Yes, I think I'll be all right.
Have you got the names, really? Didn't you remember the name? And he was so convinced that everybody attending his school was a half-wit. His eyes were shining with merriment. And he had a wonderful broad smile which was supposed to be bliss. But he was just standing in the middle of them, and it was absolutely pathetic to see them. There was a girl there with her arms out like this. The interviewer said, "You're being a tree arm, Mr. Henry, is that right?" She said, "Yes." And she was going like this, and he said, "Well, you're wobbling a bit from tree, you know." And she said, "Well, I'm not used to talking and being a tree at the same time." And he said, "What did you get out of it?" She said, "Oh, well, when we've done this a long time, we can concentrate." He said, "Can you concentrate?" And she said, "No." "Well, I think I'm beginning to do it." And he said, "What do you do next?" She said, "Meditate." "And that's very difficult." And he said, "You can't meditate then." "Oh, no," she said, "that's a long way off." Then he said to a man that was there, "I understand that some of you fellows have yogic powers. Have you got some yogic powers?" And this man said, "Yes." So he said, "Well, can you give me an example of one of your yogic powers?" And he says, "Yes." He said, "We, mind you," he said, "we're not supposed to use these yogic powers for selfish material purposes." The interviewer said, "Well, what is it?" He said, "Well," he said, "I can take colder baths than most people. So if the weather's a bit cold and I want to go for a swim, well, then I can do it." And the interviewer said, "That's a yogic power. What are the others?" He said, "Oh, well, they're like that, you know." And then in a corner there were some others harmonising themselves, shouting "Om" all together. Well, it was a wonderful bunch of half-wits. There was an Indian there who's taken this on with the reputation of India behind him, and a lot of monks there who pay him so much a year to do this. And he'd got them so well conditioned that they wouldn't tell the interviewer how much they're paying. They counted by saying, if somebody cannot afford, they will receive it free. But what it was, they wouldn't say. They were just stupid because they were looking for fruits. And he's got them completely conditioned to do quite silly things and to believe that he's the cat's whiskers in there simply because he's an Indian and yoga is supposed to come out of India. They didn't even get their terms right. They were referring to yogi as yoga and yoga as yogi, and behaving in a very, very stupid manner. And if people are looking for fruits, then that's the kind of thing that they'll get into if they're not careful. If you wind it up.
Really, the thing I've got to do then, any improvements I've actually made on myself that have been beneficial in way whatsoever, for instance, stopping drinking, perhaps stopping smoking, if I can actually lead somebody else, not only by example, but by other methods, I'm to present themselves back and to mention it to them, or lead them to a better situation where the old habits won't crop up, I'll be actually doing a good thing.
You have to be very careful about that, Tim, because if you particularise it, you can make a mistake. Because it's the whole that has got to be made whole. It's already been disrupted by the parts. There's such a thing as introducing a new disruption. It's like this interpretation and this use of the word parasite. When I used the word, and they are asked to think about it, they came to the conclusion, some of them, that I was suggesting they were parasitic on me. And that was a measure only of the idea that received the energy that was contained in the word.
In actual fact, they were quite right by that definition of parasite.
But not in the way they thought.
Not the way they thought, no.
Not in the way they thought.
Yeah.
So if you try a particular thing, like leading a particular person to, say, give up being an alcoholic or something,
not a particular idea against a particular person.
You see, that person might be going the other way. If you're concerned with the whole, one person might be going that way rather than another way. They must go that way by the definition we gave before. They're willing it.
Yeah.
That's what must be. and to deprive them of that opportunity might be doing them a disservice, might be prolonging their evolution instead of shortening it. You know that feeling that you had when you threw that thing on the floor? That's what you want. You get that feeling with people. You see, if somebody's there and he's a drunken sot, you might feel the situation like you did then, and you might say something or nothing. And if you do it with that feeling, what you say or do will be right. I once gave a drunk a bottle of whiskey when he was drunk. Tell him to go the whole hog. I said, you're not doing it right. Nowhere near bad enough. I said, you think you're being wicked. He felt he was being wicked. He got fed up. He'd had a row with his girlfriend. And he was going to show her he was no good by getting drunk. But he wanted to be only drunk enough so he could walk there and tell her he was no good. So I said, no, you must really do it. I said, then when you've done it, I'll tell her that you're no good. And she really believe it. Because I'll come and show you. He made him face the situation. He was only kidding. He didn't really want to be no good. That feeling is very peculiar because it penetrates right into the meaning of the situation. Because it is out of the continuum.
I say, Boris, I'd have to have a colour chart.
It becomes not a good thing for us. It's a bad thing. But we can't get any reason behind it.
Well, you know, it says in the book that that can't happen, doesn't it? No man is tempted beyond his strength. It's a statement about level. See, a man cannot be tempted unless he can see.
Yes, that's what comes up to me.
He must be able to see a situation, otherwise it's no temptation for him. In every temptation you have an alternative. The purpose of temporal presentation at all is to isolate problems so that you face them one at a time.